As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hey everybody, Scott Burnside back for another edition of Two Man Advantage, the podcast, the final one before the holiday break at the end of 2020. And as always, my good pal, Pierre Lebrun. All right, Pierre, I know you've got kids. What's the frantic level in the Lebrun household as we approach a week out from Christmas?
I'm way better organized than normal. I mean, usually my standard is to go out on December 24th and hit the stores.
Pierre, come on. So, such a cliche.
What can I say? I'm that guy. But this year, everything has been purchased ahead of time because I was worried about delivery and online shopping, and I got it all done. So I'm a happy man.
Well, I'll tell you, I feel like we've got an early holiday gift today on Two Man Advantage, because we are joined by one of the top agents, not just in the hockey world, one of the top agents in all of professional sport, Pat Brisson. Pat, you're in the West Coast. How is the, things are different in California. How has the shopping been, your preparation for the holidays? Are you feeling zen like Pierre, or how are you feeling?
First of all, thank you for the nice intro, Scott. Appreciate it. I'm feeling like just like Pierre. I mean, I'm the December 24th type of guy, going and running, till the shops close, and I'm coming home with all the presents last minute. But this year, I had more time for some reason, and I've been shopping online more than ever. In fact, I like to go to my door every day and see what I got from Amazon that I ordered.
Yeah,
it's amazing. So I've helped Jeff Bezos, like all of us, becoming close to a trillionaire during this pandemic. So
that's good. So Pat, I want you to, I'm so glad we're going to talk about NHL and return to play and stuff, but I'm excited on your behalf because you got a pretty special moment coming up. You've had a few special moments in the last two or three months. I'm just wondering if you can give us a little scouting report on Team USA for the World Juniors. They've got a kid up front, shoots left, born in Manhattan Beach, California. How weird is that? A first-round pick, number 29th overall, Vegas Golden Knights, Brendan Brisson. What's the whole process been like for you to go through this with your son and to see him on the verge of becoming an NHL player and heading off to the World Juniors in Edmonton? What's the process been like for you?
It's been very interesting, actually. It was a great moment last week when we found out he made the team, going to Edmonton there. And like you said, also a month and a half or two when the draft occurred and all that. So it's been Brendan's always been a pretty good player. He was just was a good playmaker and had good hockey sense, but he was a little bit on the smaller side. He's being a late birthday as well, so he kind of developed late. He went to Shattuck St. Mary's when he was 15, and he played on the 16 team, but he didn't play much at that time. And then at 16, that's when he kind of started taking over, you know, like he grew at that point. He grew a couple or 3 inches. He went from 5'7 to 5'10 and gained about 15 pounds, and confidence came with it. He started making more plays. And then at that point, he kept progressing and worked hard on his game during the off season and all that. But confidence came and became a big factor for him. And then he went from there to he played the U18 at Shattuck on the prep team, and he had a really good year there. Jackson Lacombe was playing on his team, and both of them together. Jackson was drafted that year, early second round by Anaheim. And then he went on to play USHL, had a really good year last year. So he kept progressing. It's all about progression. And but we're very, very pleased with his, you know, his progression. And it was a great, great news last week when he made the Team USA for sure.
I go back to that night of the draft, Pat, and I was, you know, thinking of you that night, because the draft every year for you is crazy. I mean, you have clients who are getting drafted, and you don't know exactly how it's going to play out. And I should point out, CAA's had a couple of big years, right, in the last mm-hmm. 2 years in the draft. So you're usually pretty busy with that, and that's got you on edge. But here you are waiting for your son's name to be called. And if memory serves right, you know, I'm not a draft guru like Bob McKenzie, but certainly Brendan was picked anywhere to go from the bottom third of the first round to the top third of the second round, right? Somewhere in that range. And he does go late first round. What, I mean, in that moment, because you have to, you're not an agent right now, you're a father, right? I mean, what's that yeah. like in terms of having it happen?
Well, it's interesting, Pierre, because usually you're right. You go to the draft. The draft is such an important moment. And we usually, that whole weekend, you're busy. You're doing deals, contract extensions, or negotiations of contracts. You're meeting with GMs. You're meeting with parents. You're meeting with the entire hockey world is there. There's so many distractions. You go to a hotel. You try to come in the hotel. Sometimes the back door to go right to your room just to real quick to – because you have no time to talk to everyone, and it has so much going on, and you can't even focus a lot of times. And so I was thinking about it when I was sitting there, because we went to Michigan that weekend to be with him. And at first we were going to do it in a room or in a hotel room, but the University of Michigan offered us a room. The alumni room was really nice. His teammates came there. But I was sitting there and I was thinking, geez, if it was a normal year, especially Montreal this year,
right?
I don't know if I'd have been able to make it, honestly, to the draft, because I would have been, you know, drained emotionally with the families and everyone. So mm-hmm. it almost worked out perfectly in a sense. Sure, I would have loved to have it in Montreal, but I was sitting there such much calmer, way calmer than I'm usually am. And ironically, my son's in the draft, and I was much calmer for some reason. And you're right. I thought, I said, you know, I think he'll go anywhere between 20 to 40. So when we came towards the end of the first round, I said, well, if it's – I kind of learned my lessons in the past, because I've seen so many kids, so many parents, so many players that mm-hmm. ranked in the first round, and they don't go the first day, and it's the end of the world that night. It's the end of the world for them. Like from first to second round, because the second round starts the next day. But I was kind of prepared. I said, if he doesn't go in the next few minutes here, because at 27, 28, 29, you know, he came out 29. But I said, oh, well, then we'll come back tomorrow. And I was much calmer than I usually am because of the circumstances, you know, for sure.
You know, it's interesting, Pat, because, you know, you have, you know, we see former players whose boys become draft eligible, and we understand that they're exposed to, you know, the hockey culture and the hockey life. But for Brendan, he saw it maybe from a different perspective, and very early on, meeting players like Sidney Crosby or Andre Kopitar, or, you know, any of the superstars that you represent. And I wonder if you remember if there was a moment where you were like, I'm not pushing him, but I wonder if this is going to be a path for him, or what that was like to watch him decide whether he loved the game on his own or not.
Yeah, there's been a lot of car rides where we go to tournaments or we go to games. You sit in the back of the car, you know, he's 7 years old or nine or 10, and like my younger son as well. And, you know, I'm on the phone with the players, and on a Sunday morning, especially Sunday morning for some reason after Saturday night, and we're driving at 7 a.m. to Anaheim or something like that, and I'm on the phone. And so I said, guys, you know, I'm on the phone right now. So, and I know that there's been so many conversations with, you know, either a player who got hurt or someone who didn't play the night before or a trade situation, so many situations. And so as he was getting older, he started asking more questions after those calls, you know, like so-and-so called. What are you going to do about it? Why is he thinking this way, Dad? You know, why? So I kind of saw these questions being asked more and more as, you know, maybe from 7 to 9 years old, you know, 10, as he was getting older, asking more questions. So I always knew that he was passionate for the game, but it's one thing. But then being more intrigued and asking questions and trying to put himself in a situation, what would I do if I was this player? So I kind of saw these signs along the way of wanting to be a player that way. But it was actually only till probably he was 15 or 16 that he became a prospect. I honestly wouldn't have recruited. He wouldn't have been on my target list of recruiting at 14, 15 years old. He didn't even get drafted in the Western Hockey League. He went in the 10th round in the USHL. So usually we target, you know, these first rounders at these levels. So it was pretty interesting. But, yeah, those were moments, I think, or, you know, when we visit a player, you know, we go to a tournament, let's say, in Chicago, and after the game we go and we see, you know, either Patrick Kane, Jonathan Taves, or Andrew Shaw, whatever. So... And being there in the moment, I think, was good for him and for my younger son, too, observing and how we interact and how these players interact. And they're human like everybody else. And especially when we speak to them, I mean, we have this line of communication where it's really there's no barriers. You know, they're telling me exactly how they feel. And so my sons were able to get it firsthand in a sense of how it is in reality. In a certain way, you know,
and I think you're not actually his agent, right? A JP Barry, your longtime associate at CAA, is the lead guy on that file, right?
JP will have the voice. I think JP will have the voice on Brendan. Let's get him to the entry level contract first.
Yeah,
his mom's gonna be his agent. They'll listen to her more than me.
I was gonna say I'd love to be a fly in the wall if you called JP to complain about his job and contract negotiations on Brendan, but and for our younger listeners who are listening, I mean they know you, Pat, as, you know, Sidney Crosby's agent, Jonathan Toews, Claude Giroux, all these stars. That's the vision of Pat Brisson that I think a lot of hockey fans have. But for the younger listeners, they may not know that you were a junior hockey star yourself on the Hull Olympics, of course, played with Luc Robitaille, played for the late Pat Burns on that 85-86 team, right? If memory serves correct, or
85-86,
yeah. And so, you know, maybe talk about that part of it, you know, that, you know, before you became this mega agent, you had your own dreams NHL-wise.
Well, that was a great turning point in my life, my career, because I played 2 years, played 1 year in Verdun. Pat LaFontaine was the teammate. Gerard Gallant was a teammate. We went to the Memorial Cup that year. Then I got traded that summer to Drummondville. And I played in Drummondville a couple of years with Steve Duchesne. That's where I met Steve and many really good players who played there. And as an overage, I was going to go to school at Ottawa University. And so I had enrolled to go there. I had a tryout with Montreal, but went to the minors a little bit before going to Ottawa University. So I started to enroll there, and I was going to play for the GGs. And Pat Burns was the coach, and Hall Gretzky owned the team. There was so much going on in Hall that we were practicing there with the whole Olympics were practicing, and they were short of a 20-year-old player, an overage player. And so I ran into Pat Burns after my practice. I said, if you guys need another overage player, I said, I'd love to play for you. I'd leave. And it took 3 weeks, actually. Pat tried to trade for my rights to Drummondville. Finally got, it was my first encounter, my first actually experience as a as an agent, so to speak. I represented myself. Charlie Henry also was involved. It was interesting. And
right.
To 3 weeks to almost a month for my rights to be traded, and then finally got traded to Hull, and then played for Pat, and then Luke Robitaille obviously was on the team, and Stéphane Matteau, Ben Brunet, I mean, Stéphane Richer. It was a really good team, a great team. And that's when Luke and I became pretty tight and became line mates. And we had an amazing year in the playoffs. I mean, Guy Rouleau, the late Guy Rouleau.
Guy Rouleau, yes. Yeah.
Guy Rouleau was outstanding, outstanding. He's arguably, probably, in my opinion, the best the best junior player I played with and against, other than Mario Lemieux and Pat LaFontaine. I mean, Guy Rouleau was, he had 92 goals in 57 games or something like that. So we had a great line. And but at that point, Luke and I became very, very close, best friends. And then Pat Burns became a really good friend after that as well. And then he became an NHL coach, and he and I, had a great, great relationship, and we spoke on a regular basis and all that. So that's how it started. That's how, because I do remember actually, when after that season, I went to play in Europe for a year, and I came back, and Burns was the coach in Sherbrooke, and I went to the Habs training camp, and then I went to the minors, and where Pat was the coach. And that's when I decided in 1987, actually, October 15th or something like that, 87. I went to Pat's office, and I was about to sign a 25-game tryout to play in Sherbrooke. And I said, Pat, I'm not going to be signing a contract. I'm actually moving to California. He says, what are you going to do there? He says, I'm going to move in with Luke. Luke and I have been talking. And don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to probably work in hockey somehow. I'm going to teach. There's a UCLA's got a little club team, and Luke tells me I can do practices there and teach hockey, and just I'll figure it out. But I'm leaving, Pat. He says, "Are you sure of your decision?" I remember sitting at his desk, and him looking at my with his eyes, and I was always intimidated by Pat Burns. Everyone was, and. I'm not going to say exactly how he said it, but you're making sure you're making that, decision, blah, blah, blah. And in a way, words. I almost didn't make the decision to come to California that day. But I packed my bags, and he wished me good luck and all that. And that's when I came to L.A., and October 15th, 87, and I never went back.
Jeez. Pat, and it's so interesting that you the story of you going to California is one that I never get tired of hearing. And I don't think lots of people may not know that, you mentioned there were some hockey schools. You were involved, I think, with Luke, but certainly in the development early on of some of the newer ice rinks. There weren't many when you got there, but you were involved in the development of ice rinks that youth hockey players could, eventually play at. And I wonder if you see, whether it's like a full circle, but, Brendan played for the Junior Kings before going to Shattuck, and you've seen the whole hockey market in all of California really grow up over your time there. And I wonder if you think about those days when you first got there and really how little there was, and maybe where it is now and how important hockey is in that sort of youth sport community in California.
Oh, absolutely. I see. When I close my eyes, I can see the entire journey from 87 on, because at that point there's no rinks in California. I was playing in an adult league when I came here just for fun, and I start teaching. I was doing a few clinics a week with this guy, Jack White. He was a cartoonist at Hanna-Barbera. And he was from Canada, and I think he was from Toronto. And Jack was doing a lot of clinics, and he's charging like 10 bucks a head. He had a bunch of kids coming in, and I was pushing pucks for him and doing some demonstrations and all that. Then there's only a couple of rinks, the old rinks, terrible rinks. And so when Gretzky got traded in 88 in August, that's when hockey really, really started booming in California. At that point, you start seeing the Michael J. Fox, the Mike Myers, the Kiefer Sutherlands of the world. Everyone kept coming to the forum, watching the Kings and being part of the Kings' lives. And then we started expanding our clinics. I had these guys. I had these guys on the ice. These adult actors and actresses and musicians, and it was an amazing boom from 88 to 90. And then the demand for ice rinks became more and more there for us. And then that's when we put the deal together. It was our first real estate slash venture, raising funds, so to speak, type of deal that we did, Luke and I, and we reached out to a couple experienced real estate developers and built the first Isoplex, the first rink. And we signed at that time a 15-year lease with the Kings we became the practice facility. But then when Bruce McNall went to jail in 93 or 94, then the team went into bankruptcy. So the lease got broken up. But the rink was sustainable. It was a great rink. And that's when the West Valley Wolves were introduced. And we put a second sheet of ice, and then we expanded these Isoplex to up north. We went to Fremont, where the Sharks were, starting also their ventures, and then down south in Escondido in San Diego, and we went to Dallas. We had in even Pittsburgh. We had six Isoplexes. Just in the early 90s were involved with that. So I got to understand a lot about the ice rink business. And that's actually when I first started to sell Dasher boards and sell the advertising on Zambonis and all that too. So we can talk about it for a long time too. But hockey really, really took off in California when Gretzky came in, and then roller hockey. And it became the things I became so busy teaching hockey on the ice. I even produced a little video, was called Ice and Asphalt. And I had many, many NHL players who came to, we were teaching ice and asphalt, what is hockey on the ice and roller, because roller hockey was a really, really big sport in the 90s, actually, on the beach in California. Like we used to play in the parking lots. So all these little pieces, if you look back, and that's why, there's four or five kids on the world junior team, who grew up in California. You have York, you have Dustin Wolf.
That's amazing.
Brian Johnson, Brendan, and actually Chris Lacombe and Hellison came to play in L.A. also for 2 years while they were playing. We went to the Pee Wee Tournament of Quebec. These kids all played in California.
Mm-hmm. And I know, like, the Sharks and the Kings have done a ton over the years for hockey development. But I tell you, the Anaheim Ducks, to me, when I research this kind of stuff, Pat, the Ducks with the high school hockey league and all that, the Ducks have done a ton over the years as well. And it's really had an impact, I think, on what we're seeing today. Before we let you go, we got to get to – let's get the modern-day Pat Brisson here just quickly. A couple of thoughts – And, probably the last question, maybe Scotty can get into this with you after I'm done here, about where we're headed in this pandemic season and the NHL and NHLPA still trying to wrap up their agreement. But very quickly, Pierre-Luc Dubois is a key high-profile RFA who doesn't have a deal yet. And I think it's probably tied to what I just talked about, waiting to see what the rules are and when we're playing, which is in mid-January. But how are talks going on the Dubois front since we have you on the show here, Pat?
Yeah, we've had more talks recently. I mean, I would say probably there were a time, maybe a month or so, where we didn't really have too much to say. Because, you know, when you negotiate these contracts, that's why you saw last year the RFAs, like the Marners, the Tkachuks, and a lot of these guys. I mean, some of these deals got done during camp or right before camp. Or I call it pressure points, you know. I mean, whether it's pressure points or, you know, when you have dates, critical dates, then that's when there's goals. That's why arbitration sometimes is a good thing, because you know that these deals would be done during that window. And so it's the same thing when especially this year, when we don't know exactly. It seems like camps will start on January 3rd now. Who knows the way things are going. So as soon as everything's announced, then you have like kind of a window, and the talks, I would say, you know, accelerate that there's more communications, there's more back and forth, like anything else. So with Pierre-Luc, we just had a few conversations in the last few days, and we'll see how things are going here in the next few days with the next steps of the NHL and the NHLPA.
Well, it's a great way to follow that up, Pat. Then what do you think it'll be like then? Assuming we get a Board of Governors vote and the NHLPA agrees to whatever the framework's going to be, and looks still like it targeting a January 13th start, do you think we will see a rush of deals that are made, or teams having to move players because of salary cap issues? We know that Tampa and a number of other teams are either over the cap or right at it. Still a handful of really quality unrestricted free agents who haven't signed with teams. Do you anticipate a sort of rush of activity then once those votes are held? Is that the kind of, you know, sort of maybe landslide of movement that we might see once things are formalized with agreements from the league and the players?
Yeah, I really do, because there's, you know, certain teams have to be in compliance by opening night, so there's going to be a lot of movement that way, a lot of excitement as well. And like I said, because it become, you know, another pressure points. We have dates in place, and we have you know, people back in offices and all that. I think the deal between the PA and the league is pretty much done. It's just you know, the Canadian authorities also. It's not easy, I guess, to navigate through Canada right now with obviously with COVID everywhere else. But I think there's certain restrictions in Canada that makes it a little harder to start. On January 3rd or January 13th, puck drop, so to speak. So, but as soon as we have all that in place, there's going to be a lot of excitement, I do believe. And what's good too is, you know, the vaccines are coming out now. We're seeing more and more. We're here. We're seeing more of the light at the end of the tunnel. I'm always the kind of guy, the glass is half full. So it's, I wouldn't call it the gold rush, but it's going to be really, an interesting month. As soon as we get the dates lined up, it's something that we can't wait. I mean, all of us in hockey and in sports in general, when you have, you know, news of league starting and dates in place, I mean, we can't wait to the world to be back to normal, that's for sure.
That is the absolute truth, Pat. And it's been so great to have you join us. And honestly, I'm sure Pierre and I could chat all day long with you. And but that wouldn't be fair. And it is great to catch up. And really looking forward to a return to NHL hockey. And I'm hoping that you enjoy watching your son and Team USA at the World Juniors, and it's going to be an exciting time. But thank you so much for hanging out with us today. It's always a pleasure to catch up.
Well, same here, guys. I appreciate your time, anytime, and happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and enjoy the holidays with your families.
Merci, Pat. Joyeux Noël.
Merci beaucoup.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Pierre, I don't know about you. I never get tired of hearing the story about, you know, how Pat Brisson ended up in California, and you know, basically on a whim, as he, you know, as he alluded to, his conversation with Pat Burns, and I'm sure Pat was very to the point, like, are you crazy? You're going to go and what, hang out? And, you know, you sort of think about, you know, what followed, you know, I mean, think about that career based on that decision. I never get tired of hearing. I don't know about you.
And I must tell you, there was a nugget there that I had never heard before. Maybe you knew it, but I didn't realize Pat Burns had tried to sign him to Sherbrooke, which at the time, of course, Sherbrooke was Montreal Canadiens' AHL farm team. You know, who knows where that would have led? I guess Pat was being honest with himself at the time and didn't think it would lead anywhere. But that's fascinating, because I had just assumed it pretty much ended after his overage year with the Hull Olympics to... But yeah, that's and it's funny. You notice he talked about the late Guy Rouleau. I don't know if you remember, Scott. Guy Rouleau was a junior machine. And in fact, the Montreal Canadiens drafted him. And of course, it's Luc Robitaille who ends up having the incredible career. Not that people didn't think he would have. He was also drafted by the LA Kings. But Guy Rouleau was, I mean, everyone was talking about him. And of course, Pat Brisson was the other winger on that line. Kind of neat.
Well, as you know, almost all the stories that we talk about have to do with me, but I was going to Teachers College in Ottawa at the for a year. I call it the Bachelor of Extended Childhood because I didn't have a job and had no prospects. And I ended up doing some reporting for the Ottawa Herald, which was the Sunday Herald, which became ultimately the Ottawa Sun. I worked with Bruce Garia, Chris Stevenson, and I did some high school sports, but I also did a few Hull Olympics games. And of course, the first time I ever chatted with Pat Burns, and you talk about Guy Rouleau and Luc Robitaille and Pat Brisson. They were dynamic players, and as Pat the reference, Guy Rouleau was unbelievable and passed away too soon. But that was my first, very first taste of hockey reporting, really. So anyway, I wish it had amounted to something, but anyway. I'm curious, you know, Pat talked about it, you know, what may happen in the coming, you know, days and weeks. I mean, the clock continues to tick as we continue to look, at least in theory, on a January 13th start for the NHL season. You continue to stay on top of this on a daily basis. Are you, your level of optimism that target's still realistic? I think a lot of us were imagining that a deal would be announced on both sides, formalized players and owners by the end of this week. Not sure we're going to get there exactly, but there's a ton of work being done on a daily basis beyond, you know, the formal signing of a deal that looks at the framework and training camp, roster sizes, protocols, what happens if teams can't play in their markets. I still remain somewhat optimistic. I don't know about you.
Well, I mean, it's going to happen. They are going to wrap this up. There will be votes and there will be a season. But whether or not it's on time for January 13th is still up in the air. I mean, you know, a week ago at this point, I mean, we're taping this here on Wednesday around lunchtime. A week ago at this point, both sides were hoping for votes by today. And then it became votes by Friday. And now I asked both sources on both sides last night, you know, are we getting votes by the end of Friday? And the answer was, I don't know. So, and it's not like there's anything going on. It's not like there's any kind of, you know, acrimony here. It's just that it's a really detailed, layered process where there's all kinds of documents. And if you remember, and I point this out because it's recent memory, but you know, the two sides were trying to wrap up the return to play package by June 30th last summer, remember? And it ended up leaking into July. It's just, there's a lot, you know, the league gets a hold of part of the document and they make changes and it goes back to the PA and it's back and forth and just so many, like this is a, there's a lot of pages to all these documents is what I was, you know, reinforced to me over the last couple of days. So hey, listen, it'll get done. Whether the vote, whether the two sides vote Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, who knows? But there will be a season. I can't guarantee that it starts January 13th, but there will be a season is all I can say at this point.
Yeah. I talked to somebody who's familiar with the process, and they said basically the same thing, but the comment was, I'm not sure where or how we're going to start that season. And it does sound like, and maybe I'm just reading body language, but it does sound like there may be more leaning towards the possibility of hub play to start, not a bubble, not players locked down, but a hub center, I assume, for each of the American divisions, if not the same in the Canadian division, where players and teams come in, play, go back to their home cities, following strict protocols that, because of the wild variation in the COVID-19 spikes and the various, you know, we've seen a lot of shifting in American different marketplaces, different areas, shifting in, you know, more and tighter restrictions on what people can do and gatherings, all those kinds of things. We always use San Jose, you know, as an example of a team that might have to start in Arizona, for instance. But I think there are a lot of teams we just don't know just yet. And my sense is
they're great examples, Scotty. Sorry to interrupt. Like what if San Jose is what if we get to mid to late January and it turns out San Jose is the only team who can't open at home?
Right.
Then you don't do a hub. You just have them play out of, like the 49ers are right now. They're football cousins, right? So it really depends how many teams have to be, like, if you can get 30 out of 31 teams being able to open at home with no fans, then you're doing that over hubs. But you're right. They are, you know, I have the same understanding as you that they are certainly examining the hub possibility. Where I disagree with you, I don't know if they're really leaning towards it yet. I think they're just making sure they're up on it. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because I think Commissioner Bettman really, really, really wants to start in everyone's market if he has any way he can do it.
Yeah, but, no, and I don't disagree with that. Well, and I guess that's it. You know, if it's one team, you're absolutely right. You just move forward. They double up in Arizona. I think you can do that with a small number of teams. But what if you've got 10 teams? Then I think that's where, you know, that becomes, and we may get to that point. So,
I have to tell you before we wrap up, like I'm looking forward to one specific aspect of this, you know, bastardized season. And that's the baseball type scheduling. I was talking to someone from a team recently, and we talked about, you know, sometimes when you do these things, something can actually stick and actually stay with when we come back for a normal season. And I wonder if fans will dig the baseball type scheduling, where what's going to happen this year is teams are going to go play two or three games in a city instead of just one game, just like in baseball. And, you know, it's expensive. Like I was talking to someone from a team who said, you know, 13 charter flight is anywhere from $25,000 to $30,000 an hour to operate. Well, you know, if you have to go to Florida twice, let's say, in a season, why wouldn't you just go once and get all those games over with? Like I think, you know, especially the way teams are going to be hurting financially for a few years now coming out of the pandemic, I just wonder if there's any way that the baseball-type scheduling will be popular enough to keep in some degree, maybe not the entire 82-game season next year, but in some pockets of it, if it makes any sense, when you have road trips to, you know, when you have California teams going to the New York area or vice versa and so on.
Well, and here's, to me, the question, how do you answer that question is, what's the level of competition like? And I think the reason they haven't done it, my sense of it is that they don't want fans to be bored. You don't want to be, oh my God, we got Florida twice this week, and you know that I want to see one of those games or none of them or whatever it is. But if you have that kind of pitched competition. And let's say, you know, and given this new, you know, the potential new setup, and, you know, Florida's coming into Carolina, and it's not just a one-off, and you're right, maybe it's two, and, you know, I don't think the math works out if it's three, but anyway, maybe it'll be three, and you're battling for a playoff spot, and there's some animosity there. Well, you want to see game one, and then you're like, well, they're playing again in 48 hours. I want back in to see that. So I think that's what you have to hope happens. And I know
that's what appeals to me. And you know, you mentioned, you think part of the reason we've never really seen the NHL is because of, you know, the fear of fan boredom. I think it goes beyond, I think the TV networks have always been against it, I think. And so, or the marketing people, so on and so on. But I'm with you. And you know, like, we see a rare example every year, like Buffalo and Toronto usually have a home and home, right? And those are, that second game is usually rocking. I mean, there's a little dislike by game two there.
Yeah.
And so I think, absolutely. I think, and I mean, at the end of the day, you don't, you know, I don't think it's ever been a criticism of the baseball. The criticism of the baseball schedules is you play too many damn games. But yeah, in terms of having to play in the same city for, you know, Tuesday through Thursday, I've never heard anyone complain about that. It's smart to get through your schedule that way.
Before I let you go, you got a piece that's coming up, and I was reading it with great interest just moments before we started taping here. And I love this because, oh my gosh, I just hope we get to this point. And I think we'll find out in the next couple of months for sure. But the idea of the 22 Olympics in Beijing, and man, when you see those the video of the vaccines rolling out and frontline workers getting vaccinated, really at various points around the world, but certainly in North America, the home of the NHL, it does make you think of better days ahead, and that makes me think of the Olympics. I loved your piece taking a look at who should or might coach the Canadian Olympic team. And, you know, we go through the debate on the Canadian roster all the time. Yes, you could have two Canadian teams, or, you know, you're right. I mean, there's no wrong answer because the talent pool is so deep, and it makes for great debate. I would argue that the talent pool for coaches is almost as deep, in the sense that there will be a lot of really talented, capable coaches who won't be considered or won't be part of a Canadian coaching staff,
right,
let alone who would be the head coach. And I wonder what you found as you were putting together this list, because it is fascinating.
Yeah, and I, you know, if I have one, and of course you're reading a piece that hasn't been published yet because you have sources and you were able to do that. If you're listening to this today on Wednesday, the piece is slated to be published Thursday. But, you know, I didn't want to list as many candidates I ended up listing, but I had a hard time cutting any of those names out because I know that in some form or another, they will be on Canada's radar to begin the process. So, you know, they will cut it down. And you know, as we reported last week on Insider Trading, Doug Armstrong is expected, by the way, to be the GM for Team Canada. He was GM, of course, when we last had best-on-best hockey, Scotty. Canada winning the World Cup in Toronto. That seems like eons ago, but that's the last time we had best on best. And he is slated to return if NHL players do indeed go to Beijing. Yes, the NHL has agreed to go back with the NHLPA, but they've not yet sat down to hammer out an agreement with the IOC and the IIHF, which is no small matter, by the way. But hopefully they can get that done. And yeah, I don't want to take away too much from the piece, but the obvious candidates are there. And I think it's a very difficult decision. But I do think what happens this year, for example, again, in this shortened season, will have a bearing. Winning is a big deal of getting in that mix.
Well, I'm not trying to steal your thunder here, pal. I'm trying to pump up this story. And but, you know, and I mean, you know, again, for me, the interesting part, where does Mike Babcock fit into this, given his incredible success at the international level as a guy who knows how to coach in a short tournament, how to get jobs done, how to delegate to, you know, whoever's going to be the head coach. I think this is always the interesting dynamic. And you go back to, you know, Ken Hitchcock and Lindy Ruff and, you know, Jacques Lemaire and Claude Julien, who played, you know, at various points on international teams for Team Canada, sort of lesser, I don't want to say lesser, but, you know, assistant or associate roles. There are going to be a lot of incredible coaching minds that can come to the table, but you got to get the right mix and you got to work together, right? Like, I think that's one of the, you know, that's part of the interesting dynamic, is it not?
Well, look at their, I mean, look at Canada's staff at the World Cup in 2016. You know, Babcock returning again, so he completed his hat trick, double Olympic gold and then World Cup championship. But his assistants were Joel Quenneville, Claude Julien, and Barry Trotz. Any of those guys could have been a head coach. And it's interesting because obviously Joel Quenneville is on my list of candidates in the piece because he somehow has been, he's missed that wave of, in terms of the best on best of not parlaying three Stanley Cups in Chicago into a shot. Now, there haven't been that many best on best events. In fact, there have been only six, starting with Salt Lake in 2002, right? There have been four Olympic games.
No, 98. 98.
I'm saying starting in 2002. Yeah, if you go back to 98, there have been seven since 98. Yes, five Olympics with NHL players, and two World Cup of Hockeys. So, and in that span, if you go to back to Salt Lake, there's only been two Canadian coaches. The late Pat Quinn and Mike Babcock have coached the last six best on best events, which is, you know, I mean, that just goes to show you how. You know, why hasn't Joel Quenneville got a, you know, there aren't that many opportunities to coach in a best-on-best tournament. So it'll be interesting. John Cooper, of course, just won the Cup. He'll be on the radar. I just mentioned Barry Trotz being part of that. You know, Claude Julien. There's just, you know, and by the way, as a teaser, Bruce Boudreau helps me handicap the list of candidates, which was unbelievable.
I know.
Of the veteran head coach to do. So, I hope people dig the piece.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. It's finely written, and I'm glad we promoted it here. So, all right. We have, you know, and I may have misspoke myself earlier. We will come back next week and do a pre-holiday podcast next week, just so you know. In between.
And by then, we might have...
Might have
NHL,
a deal.
An NHL season to announce, yeah.
Yeah, but in between, you should check out a whole host of terrific podcast fare at The Athletic. James Duthie from TSN promotes his new book, Beauties, on Craig Custance's The Full 60 this week at The Athletic, one of your colleagues, of course, at TSN. Mark Parrish, what a great story. You know, Mike Russo, just a terrific story about Mark Parrish and his battle with alcohol abuse.
Jeez.
And yeah. It was a terrific story. And Mark Parrish, he and I traded texts the other day, and I give him all kinds of credit, really, you know, sort of confronting this and sharing his story. He joins Mike Russo this week on an all-new Straight from the Source at The Athletic. What else we got here? Nick Foligno and his wife Janelle join Aaron Portsline and Allison Lucan this week on Front and Nationwide at The Athletic. If you remember, we had Nick Foligno on before the return to play. Yeah, the Columbus coming into a play-in round against the Leafs. That was a ton of fun. And Brian Burke joins the Leaf Pod with Jonas Siegel and James Middle this week at The Athletic. So you should check that out. And you should always check out our comments section for each podcast episode at The Athletic app, and rate and subscribe to the podcast on Apple. And don't forget, if you aren't already a subscriber, go to theathletic.com/2manadvantage and receive two, not just one, but two all-access subscriptions for just the price of one. My friend, it has been a tilt, as always, and we'll do it again. Maybe we'll do some eggnog next week just to close things out.
Ooh, that'll spice it up. Right on, right on.